WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Norman Mailer has chronicled his times in his works of fiction and nonfiction. He wrote about World War II in The Naked and the Dead, and the movement against the war in Vietnam in Armies of the Night. He gave his take on the women's movement in The Prisoner of Sex, wrote about an American icon in Marilyn, told the story of Killer Gary Gilmore in The Executioner's Song, in the history of the CIA in Harlot's Ghost. In his new book, Mailer takes on the Kennedy assassination by examining the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. It's called Oswald's Tale, an American Mystery. Mailer had access to KGB files in Minsk, where Oswald lived for 2.5 years after he defected to the Soviet Union. Mailer worked on this book with Lawrence Schiller. They also collaborated on The Executioner's Song. Mailer told me what he hoped to achieve in writing about Oswald.
I wanted to do a book that, in which Oswald would be as alive as he would be if he were a good character in a good novel. You know, when we think of people like Anna Karenina, or the Joad family in The Grapes of Wrath, or any, I use any number of examples, we have a picture, we understand them, they're people we can see, we can live with them, we can think about them, and I wanted to do that in this book for Oswald and for his wife, and for Oswald's mother, because I felt that once you understand that triangle of forces between these three people, you really would have something that would be interesting, and that then the scenarios could begin. There was no base to the scenarios before this, that was part of the trouble.
Your new Oswald book is based on a lot of research, and I'm wondering why you have chosen to go in a research direction in the past few years while you've been doing this book, as opposed to a totally fiction direction.
Oh, it's what I call rotation of crops. it's writing fiction is so different from investigative journalism, that when you go from one to the other, you restore yourself to a degree. After I finished Harlot's Ghost, which is a very long book, it's 1,300 pages, and it was all fiction, I just felt the need to do a book that used another part of myself. And I think it comes down to that. You write one book using one part of yourself, and then while that's recovering and filling up again, you use another part of yourself. I may go back and forth a number of times yet. If I have 3 or 4 more books to write, it's possible that 1 or 2 of them will be investigative journalism.
Where were you when you found out that Kennedy was assassinated?
I was in a restaurant. I don't recall the name. Somewhere on the east side, in the east 50s of Manhattan. And I was sitting with a couple of friends. And when I heard it, I was so cynical at the time that I said, oh, he wasn't really hurt. He's faking it to let America realize how much we need him. And you'll see in an hour or two he's going to be fine. Oh, oh, oh. When you're wrong, you're wrong. And when the news came that he died, I was profoundly shocked because I'd been so cynical an hour before.
Had you admired Kennedy all along?
It wasn't that I admired him. I'd had almost a critical relation to him. I'd written some pretty tough pieces about his actions in Cuba for the Village Voice. I'd made fun of him in pieces. I was angry at him a lot of the time. My feelings toward him were probably about equal to my feelings now for Clinton. As a Democrat, I wasn't altogether happy with him at all. But when he died, I realized that we'd lost something irreplaceable.
Now, did that make you feel bad about things that you'd said about him in print in the past?
To a degree, but, you know, after all, if you're going to criticize people, you criticize them. You can't keep being sorry for everything nasty you've ever said about anyone. Some of the time, you know, if you take away the power of criticism from American life, what are we going to have?
Are you one of the people who actually saw Oswald get shot live on television?
You know, I don't recall any longer. No, in fact, I know definitely I didn't, because I was watching a football game with George Plimpton. Comes back to me now. We were watching the New York Giants, I think, play the St. Louis Cardinals or whoever they were playing, and it came over the loudspeaker system. And what was extraordinary about that is there were 60,000 people in the Polo Grounds at the time, and this incredible, came up from the crowd. When 60,000 people make that sound, you're never going to hear the like again. And, of course, we all looked at each other and said, oh, the whole thing's a conspiracy from beginning to end.
Now, you think that there's a 75% chance, correct me if I have this wrong, a 75% chance that...
Probability, I'd say.
That Oswald functioned alone.
Well, that's just my estimate of his character is such that I think that he was enormously tempted to commit such an act because it would have resolved so many questions in his life. But it's no more than that. It is a guess. It is a conclusion. It is a speculation. Because I've been living with probabilities for so long, I took that figure 75%.
What did you find in Oswald's character that leaves you to believe that he probably functioned alone?
Well, on the one hand, he wanted to be a great man and a great political leader. And on the other hand, he wanted to have enormous attention for himself and for his ideas. He believed he was special. One of the things that I got from writing the book was that he did not see himself as an ordinary man or a nerd or a little fellow. Far from it. His circumstances might be mean and small, but he saw himself as potentially enormous, as a great leader. One of the reasons Castro was his hero is because Castro had come relatively out of nowhere and become the leader of a country. Oswald saw himself as a future Castro, a future Lenin, a future Mao. He saw himself as a great political leader. He was even fascinated with Hitler, not because he agreed with Hitler's ideas, but because Hitler, to him, represented a certain parallel to his own life. Hitler had been very poor. Hitler lived in loneliness. Hitler had read a great many books and was self-educated. And so Oswald read Mein Kampf and responded, I believe, to passages in that book. But, of course, Hitler's ideas would have been alien to him because Oswald hated the idea of a fatherland, of super patriotism, of loving one's country. His feeling is he was much more a liberationist, a libertarian. He believed that... one should have small groups and live in free association with other people with a minimum of government. He was totally opposed to both American capitalism and Soviet communism.
Having done all this research into Oswald, what do you think his mental equilibrium was? Do you think he was a sane person? Do you think he was pathological?
No, I think he was absolutely sane. He was sane but somewhat unbalanced. When you're insane, what happens is that... you really misperceive reality in a critically different fashion. If you're eating some food in a restaurant and you say, I think that they may be trying to poison us here, you're in that middle ground between dirty pots and active poisoning, if you follow what I mean. In other words, it's a somewhat unbalanced remark, but it doesn't indicate you're crazy. If you say these radishes are growing... rhubarb, then you're insane. You follow me on this?
I think so. That one has like no grounds in reality at all. One.
Yeah, or
one is pure hallucination, and the other has some ground in reality. Although, it might be
in fact, I think
an extremist explanation.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. Hallucinations are a large part of insanity.
My guest is Norman Mailer. His new book is called Oswald's Tale: An American Mystery. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Norman Mailer. His new book is about Lee Harvey Oswald. I asked him if he's been thinking about extremism and if he sees any connection between the American fringe of obsessive conspiracy theorists and the anti-government fringe allegedly behind the bombing in Oklahoma City.
Well, I think you're making a very large jump there that has no foundation at all for one very simple reason. Most of the people who are conspiratorialists who believe that there was a good deal behind the Kennedy assassination that's never come to light tend to be of the left. And obviously, the ultra-patriots who went in for the terrorist actions in Oklahoma City are the far right. So to begin with, there's no tie at all, unless you're going to argue that the far left and the far right come together, which takes a great deal of talking about because there's very little basis for that. So the difference is, on the one hand, these are people who want to, the conspiratorialists want to solve a mystery, and a terrorist wants to create mystery. So they're at opposite poles. It's the difference between scholars, if you will, and athletes or criminals or people who create violent action. The conspiratorialists are not plotting to blow up buildings. They're plotting to, if you will, they're seeking to find out what was done in the government that was not legitimate.
It seems to me that conspiracy theories, a conspiratorial point of view, is so much a part of the American fringe.
No, that's your assumption. It's just not true. How many conspiratorialists have you met? Have you met any of them ever? Have you talked to any of them ever? They're not part of a fringe. They're perfectly intelligent, reasonable people. A good many of them are academics. This is a notion to just sweep them into the corner and say they're all silly and they don't amount to anything.
No, but I'm talking about... Maybe I should just ask you straightforwardly like this. I'm sure you've been following the bombing of Oklahoma City.
Yes.
And I wonder what you've been making of what we've been learning about the extremist militias and the paranoid thinking about the government that lies behind, or that seems now to lie behind, the bombing.
Well, I've been saying from the beginning that this news is at its worst for Newt Gingrich. He's going to suffer more from this than anyone else, because Newt Gingrich has been building a notion that the world's going to be saved through technology. He's looking to a brave new future. He's a Tufflerite. He believes in the third wave, the fourth wave, and all that stuff. And what this dramatizes for me is that we're never going to have our human problems solved through technology, because technology and terrorism are umbilically related. You can't have one without the other. And it's going to increase. In other words, the more technology takes over our lives, so the more will terrorism take over our lives, because it's the reaction of people who feel they're being surrounded. When you have these ultra-right-wing terrorists talking about how the government is impinging on their lives, I think what they're really saying is technology is impinging on their lives. They're not really able to, it's as if you're not almost able to breathe anymore in the way you want to breathe. Well, people tend to assume that's the fault of the government. In fact, if they're going to look for someone who should bear the blame, it's the fault of the second government. The first government is the federal government, which has any number of good and ugly aspects to it. But there's a second government, which is as loose a congeries of associations as the first government, and that second government is the American corporation, which is taking over much more of our lives in a way through their advertising than the Soviets ever succeeded in brainwashing their people, because Soviet brainwashing was terribly crude and ugly and assertive and overbearing, and most people saw through it. Whereas American advertising is enormously successful, and it brainwashes us all the time. It impinges on us constantly. And I think that one of the ironies of the ultra-right wingers is that what they don't understand is that their real enemy is probably not the federal government so much as the second government, the corporate government, that affects our lives constantly.
You've lived through and written about the surveillance of the left in the days of the anti-Vietnam War movement. Now there's a call for new anti-terrorist laws that would enable the FBI to conduct a more thorough surveillance of extremist groups that are a threat to American people. And I'm wondering what your reaction to those proposed laws is.
You can't answer these things in 1 minute or 2 minutes. You can't say, oh, these laws are very bad, or they're very good, or they're necessary, or I regret them, but they have to be done. The fact of the matter is that the country's in very bad shape. You wouldn't have... What is shocking about this terrorist activity is these people are ultra-right-wing patriots. Now, since when do patriots go around killing children? It's not patriotic and American to go around blowing up children. It's exactly the opposite of what a patriot would claim to be. A patriot would claim to be for flag and family and country and the protection of children. So obviously we've gotten into a situation where the extremes have gone beyond themselves, and we're dealing with a new kind of extreme, which is why everyone in America is so desperately shocked over all this.
Norman Mailer is my guest. His new book is called Oswald's Tale, An American History. It's about Lee Harvey Oswald. You worked with Lawrence Schiller on your new Oswald book, and you also worked with him on The Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore. He has a bestseller now. He co-wrote with O.J. Simpson the bestseller I Want to Tell You.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder your impressions of that book. Have you read the book? And
Yeah, but I'm not going to talk about it because Larry's my colleague, and I don't want to get into what's good about the book and what I don't like in the book because it's just not relevant to why I'm here.
I wonder, too, maybe you wouldn't want to talk about this, what you think about his style of journalism, if you see him practicing a style of exploitive journalism. Or,
listen, everything you say is so loaded that we're having trouble having a conversation.
All right.
I mean, he's my friend. Everything he does is not so loaded. He was doing a job, and I don't want to get into this.
Okay. Have you been following the O.J. Simpson trial?
The way everyone else is, it's become part of my...
Well, I don't know what that means, because some people are really glued to it, and other people aren't following it at all, so...
Well, there are a lot of people in the middle who are just sort of following it because they can't think of anything better to do at 11:30 at night, so they turn it on.
So that's
I'm one of those in the middle. I'm not fascinated with the case. I'm depressed by the case. But I have enough curiosity, so I'll turn it on from time to time.
What do you mean?
I think it's a desperately bad case for America.
What do you mean?
It's bad for black and white relations,
mm-hmm.
relations between blacks and whites, because no matter how it turns out, whether he's acquitted, whether there's a hung jury, or he's found guilty, black and white relations are going to be worse after it's over. Because on the one hand, whites are going to be infuriated, and on the other hand, blacks are going to be infuriated, and if it's a hung jury, everyone's going to be disgusted with the law system, with the law courts.
Norman Mailer is my guest. Why now? Why did you decide to write about Oswald now?
Because Larry Schiller came to me and said, I have access to the KGB file on Oswald. Are you interested? We'd worked together before. I enjoyed working with him. I wanted to work with him again.
What kind of style were the files written in?
Bureaucratic style. It's in the book. If you take a look in the book, you'll see the style.
I thought maybe you could explain, you know, describe it for our listeners.
Well, let people read the book. Let them have some curiosity.
There's plenty to read. Hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Well, incidentally, I want to ask you a question.
Yeah,
why do
ahead.
People have such a horror of a long book? I mean, does everything have to be the length of the bridges of Madison County?
Why do people have such a horror of a long book? There are a lot of books that I personally feel could have used better editing, that with more time and more concise way could have been found to say what's
well,
been
I know,
said.
But then what you get into is bottom lining. You know, Thomas Mann, who's probably the greatest German novelist of the 20th century, once said, only the exhaustive is truly interesting. And the virtue of a long book is you finally have an experience that you don't have in a short book. Books have many virtues, but they don't have all of them.
I agree, but I guess what I'm saying is the opposite in a way that sometimes with more time and more thought, a more distilled book, and I'm not saying this about your book, but just about a lot of long books in general, sometimes more time into a book would create a more distilled book.
Well, my feeling is that this book is 800 pages, and if I hadn't put in that time, it would have been 1,500 pages. I did distill it. There was a mountain of material, and I wanted to reduce it to the point where it would be highly readable for 800 pages. Now, whether I succeeded or not is for the reader to decide. But when you ask me, for instance, about what was the KGB style of writing like, it's very hard to describe a style of writing to people. It's much easier for them to take a look at the style and decide for themselves. You know, the KGB style was roughly simple, bureaucratic, to the point, not terribly interested in nuance. What made the files fascinating were the transcripts of marital quarrels between Oswald and Marina. That was fascinating stuff because, my God, they behaved like every couple, every young couple you've ever encountered, if you've ever heard them having a fight. They argued over who washed the floors. It was wonderful. You know, the argument would go sort of, what do you mean that you washed the floor? You have washed the floor one time. I have washed the floor 21 times. Now, you know, it was universal.
I feel like in many ways you've been writing about the American personality from a lot of different directions.
Yes.
From, you know, between writing about American politics and the American anti-war movement of the 60s and writing about Oswald and writing about some American criminals like Michael Gilmore.
No, you mean...
Like Gary Gilmore. Forgive me.
You're in trouble.
Yeah, I'm in trouble. And I'm wondering if now... you're thinking a lot about America and America's extremes and between the O.J. Simpson trial and the terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. I wonder if you feel like you're following that with a novelist's eye and, you know, with a writer's eye, or whether that's you're just too busy to focus on that now.
You mean on Oklahoma City?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just appalled by it. You know, I think I'm reacting like an average American to that event. It depresses me profoundly because terrorism is horrible enough when the aim is to create disruption and kill a few people. But when you start killing 100 or more people and in the course of destroying half a building, obviously we're getting into something that's going to change the very nature of modern life. Before it's all over, we'll all be living in fortresses. The fear of walking the streets is so great already. This is going to aggravate everything that's bad in American life. I really think it's the spiritual fruit of Vietnam. Years ago, I wrote that that the worst thing about Vietnam is that it was going to encourage every horror in American life to rise from its sewer, to come up out of the sewer. And that's exactly what's happening. America used to be a relatively free and easy country compared to what it is now, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. So long before I can be a novelist, I'm just reacting to it as someone who just says, oh, my Lord, the life my children lead is going to be much worse than my own life.
Is there anything that you could say ties together your body of work in terms of the subject matter that interests you?
Well, I think you said it. I'm interested in American life. I've written about it from a dozen different angles. I find America endlessly interesting, or I have all through my working life. And so, I'm not at all an international writer or a cosmopolitan writer. America is what interests and fascinates me. And with the exception of one book I wrote about ancient Egypt, everything I've written has been about America. I just find it such a curious country and with so many aspects and so many sides and changing all the time that I never get tired of writing about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry Gross.
Norman Mailer's new book is called Oswald's Tale, An American Mystery. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.